This is a matter of Michael Wilson versus State of Nevada. Council President, if you're ready to proceed, please do so. Please identify yourself for the record, and if you wish to reserve time, please state how much you wish to reserve.
Your Honor, I would ask that I be able to reserve 4 minutes. May it please the court, my name is Sharon Dickinson, and I represent Michael Wilson. One of the questions this court must decide today is what type of act is sufficient to sustain a conviction under the lewdness with the minor statute. This is a statute that carries some very serious penalties, life in prison, for an act that is lewd. So what could be a lewd act? Is the touching of a child's shoulders a lewd act, or the waist, or rubbing the back? To answer that question, first I would look at the words of the statute, as it defines what a lewd act is. Under the lewdness statute, a person can be convicted if they willfully and lewdly commit an act. And that's a very specific type of act. It's any lewd or lascivious act other than acts constituting the crime of sexual assault.
Ms. Dickinson, can I ask you a quick, on the lewdness, like the touching on the shoulder and the things like that, was the jury given a lesser included of this unlawful contact with the child for those offenses, or is it just the lewdness charges? What happened there in the jury instructions?
In the jury instructions, the unlawful contact with the child was a separate count.
It's not a lesser on the lewdness charge.
That's not my understanding of the way the verdict was set up.
Okay.
There were 10 counts of lewdness, a sexual assault, and then the contact with the child. The jury found him not guilty of the sexual assault and two of the lewdnesses.
Okay.
So not only do you need a very specific type of act for a lewdness with a minor conviction, it has to be an act that is on, upon, or with the body of the child under the age of 14. But that's not all. Aside from this specific act, you need a specific intent. And that's the intent of arousing, appealing to, or gratifying the lust or passions or sexual desires of that person or of that child. So what is enough of an act? Before we get to the specific intent, what type of act is a lewd act? Well, this court answered that question in part in the Berry case. When they talked about lewd, they said that the modern authorities define lewd as pertaining to sexual conduct that is obscene or indecent. We also know that the act for the lewdness statute has to be something that is similar but different than the crime of sexual assault. It has to be any lewd or lascivious act. So under this definition, touching or squeezing the shoulders is not sufficient. Touching or fondling the waist to the side, likewise, is not an act that would constitute a crime here, before we even get to the specific intent. Touching or squeezing the upper thighs, no, that isn't either. And those are counts 2, 3, and 4 for which Michael Wilson was convicted of. You look at count 6, rubbing the butt. No, I don't think that's a lewd act either. Touching or fondling the chest. Chest is a large area, not necessarily of a sexual nature, to touch one's chest. Touching or squeezing the butt, not necessarily. All of these acts that I'm mentioning, before trial, Michael Wilson filed a motion to dismiss because he said, these don't constitute lewd acts under the lewdness statute. At most, maybe a misdemeanor battery. And I submit to you that under this statute, they aren't lewd acts.
What about the circumstances, though, that the allegation was he was showing them pornography while they're touching their shoulders or whatever? Does that change it if it's tied together with this other type of conduct?
That's a good question. I would submit that it does not, because if you look at the statute, first you look at the act, then you look at the intent with which the person acted. So under this statute, the act has to be of a sexual nature. And then there has to be the specific intent. So it's not an accident, It's not horse playing. It's not playing tag in the park. It's not taking your foot and sticking it in a hole in the sofa so that you touch the rear end of the child. All of these are the facts of this case. But before we even get to the facts, the way it's pled is incorrect. And if you then look at the facts, you can see why it's incorrect. Because it's not a crime to play tag and touch a child on the shoulders. Now, the court mentioned the pornography. And it's true that there's testimony that there were some pictures, some say naked, some say not naked, pictures of women in lingerie in the garage. Most, if not all, of these, I think only one, happened in the garage. Most of these acts happened elsewhere. And there's no way that the state can tie up what was in the garage to what happened in the park, or what happened in the living room, or what happened somewhere else.
Isn't the argument that what happened in the garage supports the inference of the specific intent in touching to arouse or have some sort of sexual component to the touching? In other words, it gives context to that. I mean, I think the state's using that garage as the source of the inference of the intent, correct?
That was my understanding. And that was a problem the district court had when she decided the motion for judgment of acquittal. Because she said none of these acts are of a sexual nature. She heard the testimony. She says it's a very unusual case. But she looked at the garage. Looking at the garage, that's one instance that happened, and that was with Cherish. According to Abriana, when she saw a picture or pictures on Michael's cell phone, it was in the front yard, he did not touch her. So no touching with Abriana with that. According to Cherish, she said that they were in the garage, and she mentioned that they did frequently go out there. Now, if you look at the preliminary hearing testimony, Cherish's mother said that sometimes Michael lived out in the garage. He didn't always live in the house because there are a lot of people living in this house, most of them sleeping in the living room, on the floor or on the sofa, probably five people or more at a time. In the garage, there were some items that belonged to Michael, and there were these pictures. There were also kids' bikes. There were also other things for a reason that a child would go out to this garage. This was Michael's house. So for the kid to go out to the garage would not be unusual. She said that when he touched her on the shoulders, he put his arm around her like a counselor would, and he also, I think, touched part of her back. And he had a cell phone, and there were some pictures on him explaining it. There's no indication the pictures were of children. There's no indication that he was suggesting to her that he was going to do this to her. No suggestion at all about that. When the police officer eventually came to the house and went into the garage, all the pictures that he saw were women clothed in lingerie. And Michael offered to let him go through everything, and he chose not to. Okay, Michael admitted to the officer at one point that he had a picture of a Playboy bunny on his cell. So that's what he remembered.
Ms. Dixon, what about the counts where there's evidence that he touched the breasts, the genitals, and the buttocks?
Okay, the count with regard to count one with Cherish, the breast, she said that she demonstrated other touching in the living room. He touched her, his hand on the part of her body below her shoulder and above the cups of the bra. He touched both sides. She said, I guess he would be playing. As I go through the testimony, you see that the children, and even some of the adults that testified, didn't know the parts of the body. And when they said breast, sometimes they meant the clavicle. They meant something else. So there was a problem with this testimony. And the trial judge acknowledged that when, I think it was Roberta who said, yes, I saw Michael touch Cherish's breast, when she demonstrated it wasn't the breast area. It was a clavicle. So some of the words they used did not describe the part of the body. With regard to count 11, touching or fondling the genital area of Abriana. That was during play. She testified. They're playing in the living room. They're playing on the couch. He's tickling them. She's laughing. She's telling him to stop. He puts his hands partially up the pants or something to that effect. And she says he touched her private. Now, at one point, she said, I can't remember if it's at trial or at the prelim or the grand jury, because this case had been around. It may have been accidental, she said.
Counsel, that becomes very important because you're asking us to overturn a verdict by a jury. And so the question is, what did, within one of your arguments, because you made multiple arguments, what did the jury hear?
Well, the jury heard, with regard to that statement, that usually he'd be playing with us all the time. This is what Abriana said. Like, he plays with us every single day we went over there. And we had shorts on or some pants or like jeans and stuff like that. He put his hand up our pants or something. And when he used to squeeze us too, then it was under our pants or stuff. And one time he went too far and hit my private. Well, he didn't hit it. He like touched it. We were in the living room. We were playing. He squeezes us. It hurts. It tickles. And she talks about laughing about it. They are all playing. There is no sexual intent whatsoever in this act.
But a jury has to make an inference from circumstantial evidence. And we, as an appellate court, we just can't retry these cases. In other words, if it's a good touch versus the bad touch. And I had a number of these cases as a trial judge, and certainly they can go either way. There's no doubt. But as a matter of law, once the alleged victim testifies that their genitals were touched, and then you look at the circumstances and they make the proper inferences, we don't want to judge again. A reasonable jury could have found that Wilson had touched the breasts, proven beyond a reasonable doubt. How do we get around that? That standard that we have, standard of review.
Well, first off, with regard to, that would just be count 1 and count 11 that we're talking about then. Count 1 was fondling the breast of Cherish, and count 11, the genital area of Abriana. All the other ones, I would submit that it's not a lewd act that's even pled or proven. In these other two instances, there was no intent. There was absolutely no intent that is playing around.
But counsel, the statute, in referring to the acts, refers to the body or any part of the body, which would seem that the legislature contemplated that lewd or lascivious acts could be performed on a child's calf, neck, head, not just their genitalia.
The way I read the statute, it begins with any lewd or lascivious act, and the fact that it follows with other than acts constituting the crime of sexual assault, I interpret that to mean something of a sexual nature. So I think that upon the body modifies that. The act has to be upon the body, but more importantly, it has to be a lewd or lascivious act, which would be of a sexual nature.
But isn't all of this driven by the intent element? Of the perpetrator. You could have a circumstance in which a grandfather is wrestling with the child and grabs them in a normal manner in which two people might wrestle. On the other hand, the same grandfather might choose to grab the child with a lewd purpose. Doesn't that become a question of fact? I mean, what you seem to be suggesting is that the court adopt a rule as a matter of law that the touching by an adult on a child of their shoulder is not within the scope of this statute.
Yes. As far as the shoulder, yes, I am saying that because that is not a lewd or lascivious act. Otherwise,
doesn't that depend on the intent of the toucher?
No, not under this statute, because the touching of the shoulder is not lewd. Otherwise, any time you touch a child's shoulder, then you would have to go in front of a jury and they would decide whether or not it was lewd or not. I only have 40 seconds left. Can I?
Before you sit down, Ms. Dickinson, I'm sure we'll give more of your time, and we'll give you some time on the other side. You raised an issue as to the use of the grand jury and kind of shopping.
Shopping. Yes, Your Honor. I raised the issue because what happened in this case is the state was not able to prove by clear a preponderance of the evidence, or rather by slight or marginal evidence in the justice court, that any lewd acts had occurred. And what they did is when they went to the grand jury and they submitted these acts and others, they also submitted the sexual assault, which was bound up. So we had two indictments for the same base scenario at the same time. One had lewd acts in it, the other one didn't. And so the suggestion is that, number one, the court couldn't have jurisdiction over both of them, and under the grand jury statutes, they should not have been allowed to go back to the grand jury, and they were simply forum shopping to find another forum that would go ahead and allow the lewdness counts to stand.
What about, State versus Turpin? You familiar with that case?
No, Your Honor, I'm not.
Okay, sure. It's an older case about where you have an indictment after there's been a criminal complaint filed in justice court and their charges have been dismissed. So I won't ask any further about it.
I would say in the brief I cited some cases where there was a criminal complaint pending, but they went to the grand jury, but that was before they had gone to preliminary hearing. And so then the indictment stood.
Okay.
Thank you. Ms. Lucich?
Good morning, Justices. May it please the Court. My name is Lisa Lucich. I represent the state of Nevada, the respondent here. The lewdness statute specifically does not say that you have to touch a sexual organ in order to be found guilty of lewdness with a child. It does not say you have to touch the vagina. It does not say you have to touch the breasts. It does not say you have to touch the buttocks. What it does say is if you commit any lewd or lascivious act other than that constituting the crime of sexual assault, which would be penetration without consent, completely separate, upon or with the body or any part or member thereof of a child under the age of 14. The statute specifically says, or any part or member of the child's body. What the trier of fact, the jury, and then this court on review must do is look at the touching and determine, based on the context or the circumstances of the actual touching, was it a lewd act and was there sexual intent? And I can't necessarily disagree, just touching the shoulders of a child, of course, would not be a lewd act. But
and,
when Michael.
In your reading of this statute, does the word lewdly, a person who lewdly commits any lewd or lascivious act, does that word lewdly add anything to the statute?
My interpretation is that it just means that it's got to be sexual in nature. The touching has to be sexual in nature. It doesn't necessarily mean that it has to be touching a sexual part of the body, because the rest of the statute specifically says, or any part or member thereof.
But then you're equating lewdly with the last clause of the sentence, which is with the intent of arousing, appealing to, etc., correct?
Well, the intent obviously has to be sexual in nature, otherwise it wouldn't be a crime. Just touching a child isn't a crime. It's the sexual intent that makes the touching, if it's not a sexual part of the body, a crime. I would submit that touching a child's vagina is inappropriate. Touching it with sexual intent is what makes it lewdness with a minor.
How do you determine that when you're talking to your alleged victims as a district attorney? I know you've done this for a number of years. You've appeared before me a number of times. When you pretrial these, especially children, how do you make that determination as a prosecutor as to whether to go forward with the case or not? What are you looking for in this case in particular?
I ask the child, how did it feel when he touched you? And these girls were both very specific that every time he touched them like this, they were uncomfortable. They told him to stop. Abriana testified that way. She was uncomfortable. She was shocked, she said, when he touched, he was reaching up her pants, and when he hit her vagina. And I would submit, when Abriana testified about, he hit my vagina, well, not hit, touched, she was 10. So when she is talking about hitting, I submit to you that she meant hitting, when she changed herself, hitting is that kind of action. And she wanted to clarify that he didn't hit her vagina, he touched it. The word kind of fell out of her mouth. But that's what I want to know from these children. How did it make you feel when he touched you? Where were you when he touched you? Who else was around when he touched you? Did he say anything to you when he touched you? Now, in this particular circumstance, both of the girls described how when he touched them on occasion, he would tell them, don't tell anyone, I'll hurt you, I'll hurt your mother or your mother's boyfriend. That demonstrates that he knows that the touching is wrong. They both told me, pursuant to your question, but also testified that they felt uncomfortable by the touches, shocked, told him to stop, wanted him to stop. While there were occasions that he did it in front of other people, specifically in front of Bobby Foster, his girlfriend Tanya's mother, in front of Janae, his girlfriend Tanya's daughter, when they confronted him because they saw that it was inappropriate touches, they confronted him, and when Janae said something to him, he said, shut the fuck up, or something like that. And when Bobby said something to him, she's an older lady, she's quite ill, she's got diabetes, she doesn't move around very quickly. He just cussed at her and yelled at her. The family was scared of him. That came out in trial, that they were frightened of him. Bobby testified that she specifically didn't call the police because when she said something to Tanya, the girlfriend, about wanting to, Tanya begged her not to call the police, threw her on her on the ground and hugged her legs, please don't call the police. There were motions or at least discussions outside the presence of the jury. It was a horribly domestic violence relationship. I recognize that that could not come into evidence, but the fact that they didn't report it, it was very important that the jury know that they were at least scared of him, and that's why they didn't report it, rather than let the jury be under the impression that they didn't report it because they didn't think it was a big deal or important or he didn't do anything wrong. They did think it was a big deal, they did think it was important, they did think he did wrong, but they were afraid of him and therefore didn't report it. And that was really only the defense attorney was asking questions along the lines of, well, you didn't call the police, you didn't tell anyone, you didn't report it. That's why it was important that the fact that they were scared came out. So these other people also, when I asked them, you know, who else was around, generally kids will tell me, but there was nobody around because people don't generally touch children in front of witnesses. That therein lies the problem with my proving most of my cases. But in this particular case, he was so bold as to do it in front of other people and then tell them, you know, you're not important to me. You know, I know you're scared of me, so shut the fuck up, leave me alone. I'll do what I want. So in the context of the way he touched them, that is how you know that the touches, while they were not to the vaginal area, the genital area, or the breasts, were still sexual kind of touchings because the girls always did feel uncomfortable. And Ms. Dickinson is not actually correct in that Cherish did testify that the touching of her occurred more than one time in the garage. She testified that in the garage there were pictures on the wall of naked bodies, or at least bodies that had some small amounts of clothing, I would submit to the court, lingerie. That Abriana testified about the phone, that she saw in the cell phone that there were people kissing. There were girls and private parts, the boy's Twinkie in the girl's mouth. I mean, you can't make that up. That is just so descriptive and sexual in nature. And while she said that she didn't see that in the garage, she saw it in front, which is right in front of the garage, right outside the garage, the way they described the house and the setup of the house in the trial. So while he's rubbing Cherish's shoulders and touching her breasts, they may not have happened at the same time, but the fact that he's done this over time for so long and where he would do it, it makes those touches that on the shoulders you wouldn't necessarily think are sexual, it makes sexual because that's what he did all the time. And I would remind the court that when he was spoken to by the detective, Lafreniere, after having been read been read his Miranda rights, he initially said, I had no contact with those girls. I never talked to them, nothing at all. I was never around them. And it wasn't until Detective Lafreniere started talking about, you know, the contacts, going to the park and, you know, Bobby and Janae and Tanya, you know, talking about going to the park and doing things with the girls, and that he said, okay, well, then the touchings weren't inappropriate. So initially, he's not being honest, demonstrating that he knows.
And that was presented to the jury, that conflicting testimony.
I apologize?
That conflicting testimony was presented to the jury by the police officer.
Yes, Detective Lafreniere did testify about that. Ms. Dickinson also talks about, you know, the touching in the shoulders and in play can't be sexual in nature. Why? Why can't play touching be sexual in nature? If you're rolling around on the floor, if you're touching and the defendant is getting sexual gratification, if he's getting hard, if he's getting excited just while they're rolling around on the floor, why can't that be sexual in nature? It absolutely can.
Ms. So Lucich, within that context, though, these are specific intent crimes, so do we have to have proven the specific intent for each count opposed to this general intent? We have the garage situation, but we have other situations outside of the garage. How do we determine the intent?
I would submit to the court that the playing in the park is not what was charged here. Whatever happened in the park on the slide, that wasn't what was charged here. What was charged here was what he was doing in the garage, what he was doing in the house. And the trier of fact in this court on appeal doesn't just look at each one touching in a vacuum. You take the other, everything into account in deciding what his intent was. And absolutely, each and every touching, he has to specifically intend for it to be sexual. But he is an older man. These girls were 8 and 10 at the time.
How old was he?
He was over 40. I don't remember the exact age, but over 40.
Careful with that older.
Younger than me still. but he had no reason to be touching these girls ever. I mean, in the park playing, okay.
And the jury looked at each count because they found him not guilty of sexual assault and 2 lewdness.
Correct.
And so they looked at each count separately.
So they did. They obviously looked at each count and discussed each count. But he was the babysitter's boyfriend. He wasn't the babysitter. He wasn't, you know, the father, the brother, the uncle, the grandpa. He was the babysitter's boyfriend. Why was he touching these girls at all, ever, unless it was sexual intent? And each and every time that he touched them in the living room, in the house, the girls said that they felt uncomfortable. I crawl into a defendant's head and take a picture of what his intent was. The only way I can prove what his intent was by bringing in all of these other things and arguing that you have to look at all of his contacts with the girls. There was nothing legitimate about his contacts with the girls. All of the touchings that the girls described, I submit, that occurred in the house and that occurred in the garage were sexual in nature. And even Janae and Bobby were so uncomfortable about it that they, being scared of him, still commented to him that, you know, that's wrong. It's not kosher. It's inappropriate.
What about the grand juries that Chief Justice asked about? What was that situation?
As far as the grand jury, I didn't really have a choice. It was the defendant who created the problem himself. At the preliminary hearing, and as I looked at the transcript, it was not Judge Zimmerman that heard the preliminary hearing. It was actually Judge Walsh, a pro tem judge, not that that makes a difference. But the girls testified, and I knew, based on my pretrial conferences with them, that I wasn't getting all the information from them. And I tried, but, you know, I can't lead them. I can't say, you know, didn't he put his finger there or touch you there. So I rested my evidence at the preliminary hearing with what I had. I disagreed with Judge Walsh's ruling, but he bound over only the sexual assault. I got a phone call, and this is all in the motions and whatnot. I got a phone call from Lisa, their mother, later that night, that as soon as they left the courtroom, basically, they told her that they were so upset because of the way he was staring them down and looking at them that they didn't feel that they could talk. And because of their age at the preliminary hearing, Lisa actually got to sit in the courtroom with the girls as their support person. And she also saw what he was doing. You know, she is an adult. She didn't feel as intimidated as they did. But don't forget, they were 10 and 12. Actually, they were more like 8 and 10 at the time. So she called me and told me that. So I went to the grand jury specifically because if I tried to put on another prelim, he would be sitting there yet again, and I didn't know that that wouldn't happen again. At the grand jury, he would not be sitting there. He could not be intimidating them, scaring them down, and they would be able to testify, and that's in fact what happened. We went to the grand jury, and not only were they able to describe the other incidents that they had described to me previously, they were also describing for the members of the grand jury how the defendant was staring them down, scaring them so that they couldn't talk. So I submit to the court that it was nothing to do with forum shopping. The defendant created the problem himself by causing the girls to not be able to speak in front of them.
Did the defense raise the issue of going to the grand jury in the district court?
Like they did.
And how did they raise a writ?
They did they did a writ and a motion to dismiss. And I apologize as I stand here. I assume it was the motion to dismiss that raised the grand jury issue. So because the sexual assault was in district court already, I submit that because I didn't have the others because of the defendant's own conduct, that caused me to be able to take the other counts and the sexual assault and just put it all together, bring it to district court. And then once the trial court denied the motion to dismiss the grand jury case, then the other case got dismissed.
That was the information got dismissed.
Correct, and we proceeded on the indictment. Unless the court has any further questions.
There's an allegation of prosecutorial misconduct in the argument, but it doesn't appear there was any objection made to the argument. Do you have any comment on that?
I disagree with the defense that I committed any misconduct. I would submit that what I said was appropriate. When I said that the girls, this is what they had to look forward to, they had nothing to gain. And that was my whole argument, was they're trying to say that these girls are making it up, but why? Why would they make it up? They have absolutely nothing to gain. On the contrary, they had everything to not lose, but the discomfort of having to talk to a detective, have an examination, come to a prelim where they were scared to death, then they were, you know, gratified enough so that they got to come back and testify at a prelim. And how did we pay them? Then they had to testify in a trial as well. So this is everything that the girls went through just because they wanted this to stop and for him to not be able to do it again. That was not objected to.
You were commenting on the evidence, basically.
The evidence that the girls went through. Also, not only did they not object to it, I would submit that there's no plain error because they haven't demonstrated how there was any prejudice as a result of what was said. So I don't believe I did put myself in their shoes, but if you think that's what I did, it was not error. Any other questions?
Any additional questions?
I thank the court for their time, and I would ask you to uphold the conviction. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Dickinson, we chewed up your time. We're going to give you 3 minutes to respond.
You know, I feel bad right now. That doesn't mean I'm a victim of a crime. The touching, just because the person feels bad when they're touched on the shoulder, doesn't mean they're a victim of a crime. That's inappropriate to suggest that alone is sufficient for somebody to spend the rest of their life in prison. To suggest that the sexual intent modifies the act, so no matter what the act is, if we can prove somewhere, somehow, you had the intent to maybe look at some women in lingerie, you're guilty and you're going to prison for the rest of your life. It's just not fair. How do you defend yourself against that? I think that the legislature realized that. That's why they were very specific with what type of act is needed. It's not just a fleeting touch. It's something more to put you into prison for the rest of your life. We talked about the facts, and I would ask that you go back and look at the facts because so many of the things that Ms. Lewis just said were inaccurate. And I don't have time, unfortunately, to go through all of them. She suggests that this is such a horrific event. It was going on forever. But we know the kids were not even in the house. They weren't in the house all the time. It was Michael's house. That's why he was there. His girlfriend was babysitting. Hotshot was babysitting. And he was babysitting. And he was playing with these kids. It is his house. He had a right to be there. And he was helping this woman with the kids and babysitting. Like I said, if you look at the facts, and as far as Bobby, the blind person who could not even recognize faces in the courtroom, how could she recognize anything else that happened? He wasn't bold. He lived there. It was his house. There's no evidence of some of the things that Ms. Lucia said. No evidence of him getting hard and getting aroused and masturbating. Nothing at all like that. It is child games, playing tag, playing in the park, playing on the sofa, because apparently that's where everybody congregated, on that sofa. And there's a hole in that sofa, and he would take his foot sometimes and stick it into that hole. And you know what? He's spending life in prison for sticking his foot into a hole, and the child happened to be sitting there. He's playing around. No one should be convicted of lewdness for that act or for any of these acts here. She blames Michael for her going to the grand jury. She blames Michael because nobody saw these so-called faces. Nobody saw it. She didn't see it. Defense attorney Michael didn't see it. But it's Michael's fault that she had to go to the grand jury.
Should she have ignored the mother calling her, the woman calling and saying the kids were scared to death? Should she have ignored it as a prosecutor?
No, I'm not saying that. But I'm saying that there was a question about whether that occurred. And it's not Michael's fault if the justice of the peace saw the testimony. If you look at what the detective said, you will see that these kids did not say much at all when they were interviewed by the detective and by the medical people. Their story just started going like a snowball, especially when the prosecutor started interviewing them. It got worse and worse and worse. So I ask you to look at the facts again and look at the statute and reverse his convictions. Thank you.
Thank you. I thank counsel for their arguments this day. This matter will stand submitted.